Shalom and welcome to another in our series of podcasts from Temple Beth Om, a dynamic center for conservative Judaism in Los Angeles. This is a recording of Rabbi Adam Klickfeld's weekly Rashi study class.
It's been a while. Kudos to those who are as jet-lagged as I am and are still in the room to study Rashi. But really, all we did for 2 weeks was talk Rashi. We were talking Rashi in Bosnia, talking Rashi in Serbia. We're down some equipment in the building right now for a bunch of reasons. So there are no microphones in the room. So it's going to be a lot of me today. And I apologize for that. We had several hours of power outage yesterday and actually threw a bunch of things into disarray. And the equipment that we normally use is not available. So you can see who's on Zoom, and the people actually who are on Zoom can participate, but the people in the room will not necessarily be able to be heard. So I'll do most of the talking and reading. Can you guys hear me on Zoom? Good.
Yes.
Good. So let's jump into it. I have us having finished verse 28, including the Rashi of chapter 9. We're getting towards the Maftir Aliyah of Parshat Va'era, so we're in smelling distance of the next parsha, which means that Exodus is happening soon. And the verse that we left off on that we'll just repeat again just to get some momentum. I'm actually going to do the two verses, 27 and 28, because it's been a few weeks and they're a couplet together. V'yishlach paro, Pharaoh just, sent for, v'yikra l'Moshe u'l'Aharon, and he called Moses and Aaron. V'yomer aleihem chatati hapam, he said to them, and we discussed this at great length, this time I'm wrong, or this time I've sinned, something like that. Adonai hatzadik, God is the righteous one. Vaniva ami harasha'im, I and my people are the wicked ones, or the bad ones. And then, continuing in what he's saying to Moses and Aaron, ha'atiru el Adonai, plead with God, entreat God, pray to God. That root ayin taf resh, which is not really used very often in modern Hebrew, is a biblical word for prayer or to make an entreaty. We first learned that word when Yitzchak prays that his wife Rebecca become pregnant. V'rav miyot kolot Elohim uvarad. And we spent a little bit of time on what the word rav here means, and Rashi read it as enough. He plead with God because enough already from there being kolot Elohim, these thunderclaps of God, uvarad, and hail. V'ashalcharchem, I'm going to finally send you. V'lo tosifun l'amod. You will no longer linger here. This is not Pharaoh saying you're not going to be able to stand up straight. This is, you will not continue to linger, lamo, to stand here, meaning, uncle, I give up, at least for now, okay? That's where we ended off last time. Did anyone have anything that they remember they wanted to say about that verse of the Rashi before we go forward? Okay, again, I'll do most of the reading because I'm the only one whose face is close to the microphone. Verse 29, Vayomer Elav Moshe. Ketseti et ha'ir, efros et kapai el Adonai, hakolot yech dalun, v'habarad lo ye'od, leman teda ki l'Adonai ha'aretz. So this is Moses' response back to Pharaoh. Pharaoh had been speaking to Moses and Aaron. Interesting, that's only Moses speaking back. Ketseti et ha'ir. How would someone want to render that phrase?
As I go out of the city.
As I go out of the city, right? Very good. Say T from the say to leave, et ha'ir, as I leave the city. Just to predict Rashi a little bit, in English, the word to leave can seem like it takes a direct object because the preposition that's there is not present, but it's an indirect, it's an intransitive verb, not a transitive verb, right? You say I'm leaving New York, but what you mean is I'm leaving from New York. Right, so it's not like to leave something transitively means to leave something behind, right? So here, what we would want it to say is ketseti mihair, right? Because it's not that he's leaving the city in the sense of he's doing something to the city; he's leaving from the city. Rashi is going to play with that, but if you look very quickly at the unculus, the amar le Moshe, Moses said kimifke when I leave min karta. So unculus says, pay no attention to that et. It's not a direct object. It means from, right? Efros et kapai, I will open up and extend my palms. El Adonai, towards God. So I will pray. If you look at Unkelus again, Efros Yadi, so that's the same as I will Efros et Kapai, I'll open all my hands. Bit slow Kadam Adonai. What does slow mean in Aramaic? Prayer, like Tikabel slow tone. So Unkelus basically says that the meaning here is not just I'm going to extend my hands, but I'm responding, Pharaoh, to your request that I pray. I'm going to pray. I'm going to daven. Hakalot yechdalun. All of those awful sounds that you've been plagued with, pun intended, will cease. Chadal means to cease. We first have the word chadal. You want to know the first place you have the word chadal in Torah? It describes Sarah when the messengers come to tell her that she's going to be pregnant. And the miracle is chadal liot ksara orach kanashim, that she had already ceased from, you know, being thought of being fertile, right? So I guess it's not a root that we see that much in modern Hebrew, but biblical Hebrew means to end. So these sounds, these voices, these thunderclaps will end. V'habarad lo hiyaod, there will no longer be the hail. Lama'an teda, so that you will know. Ki l'Adonai ha'aretz. How would we phrase ki l'Adonai ha'aretz? How would you translate that?
That the land belongs to Hashem.
That the land belongs to Hashem. So then what's the logic? Okay, Pharaoh, I'll go out. I'll pray to God. And don't worry, it'll happen. Everything's going to stop. There'll be no longer hail. And the reason for all this is that you will know that the land belongs to God. What's the logic there? How does A lead to B?
Shows the causation.
Say more. What do you mean it shows the causation? And I'll repeat everything it said
it's
for everyone.
It's not just a random act. It's the fact that it stops exactly when you praise to God. So obviously God is almost controlling.
Right. So your sense of self, Pharaoh, is that you are in control of everything, right? And this whole drama, which we see now for page after page, is to reinforce to you that you're in control of nothing. In fact, the one I work for, like currently the slaves work for you, but the one I work for, that one, that's the one who controls everything. When it starts, when it stops, when it begins, when it ends, when it wanes, when it strengthens. All of this that you think you rule, God rules. Mm-hmm. Sue?
I think it's more than that, though. He said, because the land is God's, it's his to destroy, or his to make fertile, or his to flourish, or his to ruin. And it's really all in his hands. It's not just that he can start it and stop it, but it's not even yours in a way.
Yeah. So what Sue said is that reinforcing to Pharaoh, none of this really belongs to you. And therefore, when you arrogate to yourself a certain authority and power to do with the land with what you wish, you're trying to control something that not only you can't control, it's not even yours. It's God's.
Arrogate?
To arrogate to yourself means to claim for yourself something which you shouldn't. I arrogate to myself the right to, you know, call on people that I like calling on and not calling on people that I don't. Just kidding. Rick.
Does that mean you like me?
I'll never tell.
Yeah. So wouldn't it have been better, Kila Adonai HaShemayim? God is controlling the heavens. Just a question there.
Why is that better?
Because everything's coming from the heaven. It's not like there's things happening on the earth. It's things coming down. So it would make more sense that Moses would say, you should know that God is controlling the heavens.
Uh-huh.
It's off somehow. But so, it's okay. It's just off.
I'll let them know that you that it's okay. But if you were to answer your own question, if you think that Kila Adonai HaShemayim would be the more reasonable phrase, then make the argument for therefore why it's Kila Adonai HaAretz.
So why is it written that way?
if we accept
what Susan was saying and Norm, that God controls the earth, but it's always Shemayim va'aretz, and And here the stuff is coming from the Shemaim. It's not like the river rose up and turned to blood. That's a land thing. It's not a heaven thing. So just saying. I do like the Munach Zakef Katon on the Mont Teda standing by itself. That's it makes it really, really important that you should know things. The Yodea is all over the Torah, of course. And a lot of times it's with Munach Zakef Katon.
Yeah. Or Munach Katon in the way I learned it. Thank you, Rick. Rachel, see if you can speak loud, and I want to see if you could be heard on Zoom if you speak loud.
Okay. Teacher voice.
Teacher voice. Yes, I remember my teacher voice.
Can you hear her while she's talking like that way? Yes? Okay, good. If you came late, by the way, we're down some equipment, so there are no microphones in the room.
Okay. I'm concerned in this part of the conversation that, I mean, we hear of Moses and we have this image of Moshe as simply repeating what God told him, but I'm getting a sense of he's matching his own importance to Pharaoh's, that it's not only that God is in charge, it's that I've got the pipeline to God and you don't.
Mm. So, Rachel, you're saying you're reading into Moshe's words here, not only an aggrandizing of God, but therefore an inverting of the apparent power structure between the two of us, right? Yes. So it's not just that I'm inverting you and God, I'm also inverting me and you, because I work for the one who's actually in charge. Interesting. Okay. Was another hand up? Marshall, and then...
This reminds me of the verse from Psalms, Ladonai ha'aretzim lo'a, tevel v'yoshveva, that the earth belongs to God and the world, everything in it.
Yeah.
So that's why I think it's ha'aretz here. But we also know ha'shamayim, shamayim, ladonai, heavens belong to God.
Yeah.
Ha'aretz not timely nei adam, but the earth gave to man.
Yeah, ladonai ha'aretz from lo'a, that the earth belongs to God and all that's in it. Well, that's fullness. The fullness. That's one. That's often when people will get a new book and they'll write, and the inside cover of the book, that's the half verse that people write for some reason. As to suggest, I just bought this book to add to my library, but I don't own anything. Everything, including the wisdom and the pages in this book, belong to the Holy One. Tova?
I'm intrigued by the beginning of this, that Moshe says, as soon as I've gone out of the city, then I will do these things. And I'm not quite sure how to read that, whether it implies that he is distrustful of Pharaoh, so he's going to make sure he's out of the reach of the more direct forces that he could bring against him, or it almost seems to suggest at a limitation, like somehow the city would inhibit him from demonstrating or praying to God and demonstrating his power over the land. It's a weird...
So to that I say, Baruch Shekivant, good that you had that question, because you anticipated one of Rashi's questions. So so we'll get to that. Let's actually look at the Rashi. And we've now mentioned both of the things that Rashi is sensitive about. He's sensitive about the presence of the word et in the verb, between the verb kitseti and the word ear. And then he's also sensitive to the second question. So again, I'm going to do the reading today because we have the microphone. Kitseti et ha'ir. Rashi basically says Unglis was right. Min ha'ir. He doesn't explain it, right? He doesn't give you a lot of examples. I'm going to bring some examples up, but Rashi just lets it stand for itself. I know it says et, it means mean. Sometimes that's what Rashi does. But I want to show a couple of places where, in verses that you might even find familiar, where this is the case. So one second, I'll put on the screen. Okay, so Breishit, chapter 6, verse 13. We are in Parshat Noach. Verse 12, Vayar Elohim et ha'aretz, God saw the earth. V'hinei nishchata, it was yucky, it was depraved and destroyed. Ki hishchit kol basar darko, every living thing had corrupted its way. Al ha'aretz, on the land. Vayomer Elohim lenoach, God said to Noach, Kates kol basar balafanai, the end of all flesh is coming in front of me. Ki malah ha'aretz chamas, the land is filled with Hamas here just means violence. Mipnehem in their presence. Hineni mashchitam et haaretz. Therefore, I'm going to destroy them. What's the next English word? From the land, right? He's not. There's no way to describe it as anything other than I'm going to rid the land of them. So even though there the verse is, the word is hinei mashchitam et haaretz, I'm not destroying them, the land. I'm destroying them from the land. Et means mean. Et means mean in our verse as well. Okay, so Rashi doesn't bring that example, but it's the same basic commentary. And then he gets to the thing that Tova was just referring to. Aval betoch ha'ir lo yipalel. How come we didn't daven in the city? Lefi shehaita mle'a gilulim.
That's the shul I don't go to.
If you didn't hear that on Zoom, Joel says, that's the shul I don't go to, but I'm bummed. Right, so why didn't he pray in the city? You may ask in a Tevye voice. Oh, I can't believe what we saw in driving through former Yugoslavia. I don't know if I put this in. Yeah, but it was, we're driving through the countryside and someone just says to the person on the bus, this kind of looks like Anatevka. This is, what were we in? What country were we in even?
Croatia.
And the tour guide said, well, Fiddler on the Roof was filmed right here. Like,
it's just true.
It was filmed 10 miles away. So it wasn't just randomly that it looked like Anatevka. They chose it because it was Anatevka-ish.
And there's pretty amazing discussion about diverting too.
Yes, Alan.
The whole notion of Anatevka, the origin of that really means Ein Tikva. There is no hope. Mm. That's how they got the name Anatevka, to be able to do that for the movie. Mm-hmm.
Is that true?
Yes.
Wait, but what do you mean for the movie?
No.
I mean for the singer's story.
Yeah, for the story, but they called the town Anatevka, relating to Ein Tikva. There is no hope.
So what Alan is saying is that the origin of the name Anatevka may be Ein Tikva, but there's a switch of the consonants. It's Ana, so they switch the K and the V.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll buy it. I did not know that. How did I get to Anatevka? I lost my train of thought.
Somebody mentioned Tevye.
No, how did I get
to Tevye? Can
you ask the question in a Tevye-esque way?
Oh, okay. Thank you. So basically Rashi says, why does the Torah make it explicit that Moshe says, I will do indeed what you say, but I'm not going to do it in your presence? You could give several different arguments. And the Torah's argument or Rashi's argument is that you don't daven, you don't entreat the God in the place of idolatry, right? It was filled with gilulim, idols of idolatry. What's interesting about that is that, do we not think that Moses had pleaded with God up until now in this wow, extended scene? There are rules in halakha about where one cannot daven, right? You're not supposed to daven in a smelly place, right? Because you want to be able to have all of your senses lead you to the spiritual, and we can't avoid smelling the things that we smell. Sometimes there are rules that suggest that you can't pray if by praying there you're going to give the misimpression that you're praying to an idol, right? So in the ancient world, they used to consider trees to be demigods, right? So there are some people who will dafka not pray on the side of the road if they're standing right in front of a tree, lest someone make the false impression that they're considering the tree to be the divine, right? So there are still places in Jewish practice that this is relevant. And here, this is just Rashi's way of showing how frum Moshe was, right? He wasn't willing to pray in the place of idolatry. He had to leave the city in order for the prayers to be valid or legit. Marshall, and then Tova, and then Joanna.
Yeah, just a comment on the, this is the Gilbert, Peshat Lishutosho Rashi,
yeah,
which says that based on the statement by Imr Moshe, behold, I'm leaving you, and I'm going to pray to God for their gods, right? For their allele was their tzon, their sheep. Hayubasadeh, they were in the field. Ah, kisha hitra bahem Moshe, amakata barat. But when Moses warned them about the plague of hail, hayareda debar Adonai b'chule, heviu et mikdehen, they brought their animals.
Right.
Into the city, Bahayatamalaya Gilulim, and therefore it was full of idolatry.
Ah, so it's not just that in general Egypt is a place of idolatry. Right. You're saying that there's actually idols everywhere because of the warning of the previous plague. That's very interesting. I would not have come up with that secondary insight. Tova, then Joanna?
While I think that's a very good interpretation on his part, and probably correct, it's still already at this point, it's not just Pharaoh that is being challenged, but the gods of Egypt that are being challenged. So in a way, you could have turned it the other way around and that he would begin praying in the city to show that even in the face of the presence of the Egyptian gods, his God was paramount and he could address them even among the gods of Egypt.
Yeah, so I love that comment because it's a wonderful reminder that while this year-long exercise that we are all in trying to make sense of these verses, that when one makes a very strong agadic argument for why the verse means this or why the verse should mean that, there's an equally strong counter-argument that it could have been the exact opposite, right? That the stronger statement is not to say I refuse to pray in front of idolaters or idols, but that I'm going to bring my God and my spirituality into the place where the idolaters are, and that's a stronger kunz, that's a stronger defeat. So the Torah only had, like, Rashi only has what the Torah gives it to work with, and so that's why Rashi gives this reading, but you can argue the opposite direction pretty strongly. Joanna?
I'm not familiar with Rashi's use of the word gilulim for idols. Any comment on that?
No. It's one of the words at gilulehem. It's a biblical and rabbinic word. Why the word gilul means idol, I don't remember, right? I can't think of the etymology offhand. Galal, to roll something, I don't know. But it's a relatively common word to use interchangeably with objects of idolatry. Eight gulehem, eight ve'evin. I forgot what verse that's from, but it's a common way of referring to an idol. Marshall.
It's also in the second paragraph of the Olenin. Right?
Fine.
Alkena kaveh v'chana, they wrote here, v'avir gilulim min ha'aretz.
Right, good.
Right. In addition, the source that Rashi is quoting from is from the Mechilta, where he says, mipnei she'hayatam aleiha shikutzim v'gilulehem. The abominations and their idols. So it's a fuller thing, not just idols.
Good. Leonard. Oh, Leonard's just waiting in the room. Norm. No, Diane Larry.
So I apologize. I missed most of the discussion, but I think I understand that you're on the Rashi and the explanation for why it is that Moses is it says when he leaves the city, he'll do it, right?
Correct.
So I didn't have a chance to say before we got to the Rashi. It seems to me that this is a the Peshat way of looking at it, instead of explaining why it is that Moses has to leave the city, is to say, I'm not going to stop the hail until you've actually left me out of the city. So the deal is, we're having this bargaining back and forth, or extortion, or threat, or whatever it is. And so it's like holding a gun on someone and saying, all right, I'm holding the gun on you until I leave the room. Don't do anything for a minute after I leave the room, or something like that. So it seems to me there is a simpler explanation, which is he's saying, okay, you've said we can leave. Once we've left, then the hail will, then I'll take the actions to make the hail stop.
Very nice. Lest you hold us hostage until we do what God you want God to do.
Right. If I make the hail stop right now, you'll just say, no, don't go.
Got it. Okay. I think Norm wanted to say something.
I was basically going to say exactly what Larry said, because after all, we have eight previous plagues, and every single time Pharaoh has changed his mind, hardened his heart, and said no. So now at least we'll be gone, or at least Moshe Rabbeinu will be gone, and maybe he'll have one last chance to not harden his heart.
Yeah, good. Great. It's a wonderful thickening of that verse. Okay, that's everything on verse 29 that Rashi says. Going once to verse 30, going twice, yalla. Verse 30. This is now still in Moshe's voice. So Moshe spoke in verse 29, and he's now speaking in verse 30, still speaking to Pharaoh, meaning he hasn't yet left Pharaoh's presence to do the praying that he's saying he's going to do. V'atav avadecha yadati ki terem tir'un mipnei Adonai Elohim. Okay, this is a very compact verse, and let's decipher it word by word. You and your servants, Moses is saying, yadati, I know, and it's unclear, should it be yadati atav yavadecha, that I know something about you and your servants? The placement of the yadati is interesting. Rick might point out the interesting trap there, that it's you could imagine the Adati being first, but it's after the Ednachta, and it stands out musically. Ata b'yavadecha yadati, I still know. And then Yativ. Ki terem tir'un. What do I know? I know that terem tir'un. Terem is an interesting Hebrew word. Anyone have an association with the word terem means? It could mean until, yet, before, something like that. It's very hard to translate. It's even hard to figure out what figure of speech it is. It has something to do with not yet or in a pre-stage. Tir'un. What do we think the root is of tir'un?
Yud
resh aleph, meaning fear or awe. Yeah. So as for you and your servants, Moses says back to Pharaoh, and this might strengthen Norm and Larry's reading, I happen to know that terem tir'un, how would you render that in English, given how we...
That you're about to be, fearful, that you're about to be overwhelmed by fear and awe.
I think the not yet is better, right? That I happen to know that we're still in the before stage. That's what the terem kind of means.
Not fully.
We're still in the pre-stage of you having yirah, having awe for God, meaning... You're trying to eliminate consequences to yourself, right? I mean, every parent has been through 1,000 interactions with this with their child, right? Where before the child experiences any remorse, they just want the punishment to stop, right? That doesn't mean that they've learned their lesson, right? So we're in the terem stage. You don't have awe yet. You're not really submitting to God. What you do is you'll say anything you want to say to remove the punishment, right? This is why some people say why torture doesn't work, right? Because someone being tortured will say anything to get the torture to stop. It doesn't mean that what you're getting from that person is necessarily good information. Back to our regularly scheduled programming. Mipnei Adonai Elohim, in the presence of, before Adonai, who's our God, okay? It's saying a lot in a short bunch of words, and the terem is one of the questions. Larry Dayan, is your hand up again or still?
Just to say, terem is the name of a network of emergency clinics in Israel, spelled exactly that way.
Is it an acronym?
I don't think so. I don't know. Is there any way we can get emergency out of terem?
We're here before you even knew that you needed us.
Right. Or before you've been fixed up or.
I don't know.
Right. I'm looking up terem online. Yeah. Yeah. Now that I see it, it's familiar. I would not have remembered that. Why? I don't know. Yeah. Could be someone's name. I don't know. I mean, could terem mean like. Almost like instantly before you even know that or even expect us to come, we'll be there. I don't know.
That's what Diane was saying. although it's a, I don't know if they actually, do they have the emergency vehicles? Because it's a clinic. It's a, what we call here urgent care.
Right. It's interesting. If someone could find out, I'd be.
Renee's not around, huh?
Why is it called Terum? Yeah, I don't want to waste the time to do it right now. But it's interesting.
It's in the Rashi, right? It's in the Rashi coming up, right?
Well, the description of what Terum means in the Rashi, but why a chain of emergency clinics called that, I'm not so sure.
Something. I don't know what the test
is. All right. It's a challenge. Okay. So let's look at Rashi on Terim. Okay. Terim Tirun. Adayin lo Tirun. Still not. Right? So you think that's what it is? Tipul refuah miyadi?
We made it up.
That works, actually. Medical, yeah. Instant medical care. Tipul refui miyadi. All right. That's what I'm going with. And if it's not yet what it means, they have to rebrand themselves that way.
Tipul's a tet, yeah?
Tipul's a tet. Okay. So Rashi says, if you're wondering how to handle terem, adayin lo, not yet. We're in the before stage. It's not yet that you have off or God. V'chein, and while we're at it, Rashi says, kol terem shlemikra, anytime this word which means more than one English word or even one conceptual word in a brain, every time it appears, adayin lo hu. And the adayin lo should be in quotations. What it means is still not. V'eino lashon kodem. Don't be tricked into reading this as before, because beforeness is also somehow related to this idea, but it's not before, meaning it's not that Moses is saying to Pharaoh, before you have awe for God, but rather you do not yet have awe for God. There's a super commentary in Rashi that says this, Kolomar ein ze tziyun zman. This is not a word that has to do with pointing to a particular time, tziyun zman, kodem shiratein, before you have fear of God. She'im kein, if that's what it would have meant, hayakatuv mifaresh v'holech, the verse would have had to keep going, mahayalahem kodem sheyaruot adonai, what happened before they feared God, now that they fear God. Ela inyan bifnei atzmohu, it's actually its own idea, adayin einchem yireim et adonai, still don't have awe for God. Kimo, and now we do a very Rashi thing. We bring a couple of verses. So I'm going to bring them up to you. And some of these are verses that, again, you have some familiarity with. So let me share the verse, share the screen. Okay. Genesis 19:4. One second. I don't like this translation. Let's choose a translation. Shocking. Okay. Anyone know? Just by looking at these two verses, what story we're in? Oh, they're too far away. We're in Sodom and Amorah, Sodom and Gomorrah, right? We're Lot's predicament, locked in the house. Vayivtzar ba'maod, he pressed them hard. V'yasuru elav, they turned onto him. V'yavo el beito, they came into his house. Where he's not able to like hold off the mob. V'yas lehem mishteh, and he made for them a party. Umatzot afa biochelu, he baked matzah and ate. Terem yishkevu, the anshe ha'ir anshe sedom nasobu al habayit. So it hadn't even yet happened that they had lied down. Terem, right? That the people of the city of Sodom came and they surrounded the house, right? This is where everything gets very tense. So here, terem, even though in English the word before could work, because we can use the word before to mean not yet, right? Before they had a chance to lie down, what we mean by that is saying they hadn't yet lied down. But Rashi wants to make it clear that it doesn't mean before the way the Hebrew word kodim is used to suggest that we're describing something that already happened. It's just, it hadn't had the chance, they hadn't had the chance to lie down, and the mob was imminently around them. So that's the first thing that Rashi says, Kamo Terem Yishkabu. And then we look at, and Unkelus, look how Unkelus translates that. One second, Targum. So Unkelus translates, the screen is up right now. Ad lo shchivu. Not yet, ad lo, right? Not yet had they laid down, and therefore, this is Rashi's using that as a proof that that's what terem means. Now we have another one, terem yitzmach, earlier on in the Torah. This is second chapter of Genesis. This is the beginning of, it's the second telling of the creation of the world. And also the translation is off. So if you look up a verse, Eile toldot hashamayim v'haaretz, these are the stories, the begettings of the heavens and the earth, b'hibaram, in that they were created, b'yom asot adonai elohim eretz v'shamayim, the day that God created the heavens and the earth, b'chol siach hasadeh, all of the bushes of the field, terem yihyeh ba'aretz. Terem here doesn't mean before, it means they didn't exist yet. And even the word v'chol here is hard to make sense of. So look how Everett Fox translates it. No bush of the field was yet on earth. So the v'chol means all of what you consider to be vegetation, terem yihyeh ba'aretz. It wasn't yet there. And we don't have to look at it, but Rashi brings the unkelus on that. Ad lo tzamach, had not yet flowered. Avze kainhu. So just like the word terem in those two verses that Rashi brings means not yet, it also means the same thing here. Yadati, I, Moses, know, ki adayin einchem yireim. You still do not have proper fear of God. Umishetihyeh harvacha. Once you get a little break, once this plague is over and you can recover, ta'amdu bekilkulchem. You will what?
Neg.
You will reneg, right? You will continue in your brokenness, literally. Ta'amdu. You will continue to stand bekilkulchem in your broken ways. So what Rashi pulls out of Terem is this idea, don't think, reader, that Moses is convinced that Pharaoh is sincere, right? We're not there yet. In fact, we're never going to be there. Pharaoh keeps, because we know the story, going back until he's eliminated. Elon, and then Joel. Speak a little louder, Elon.
Yeah, if Moses doesn't think that there's any shot of Pharaoh redeeming himself in any way, why bother going through the motions? What's the explanation for that?
I mean, that's the question on the whole 10 chapters, right? 8 chapters. What is this all for if we don't think that when Pharaoh relents, he's showing sincerity and genuineness?
No, but I understand that from God's perspective. I think I understand it from God's perspective. But Moses always seems to be a more hopeful character, right? Uh-huh. So if he doesn't believe, so it's clear that God knows that Pharaoh won't change his mind. But Moses at times seems to be more hopeful. Mm. Right? So why even go through the praying if he's like, yeah, I'll do this, but it's a waste of my time.
Yeah. That might be a question left unanswered, right? That, you know, Moshe is both, he's a servant of God doing what God wants him to do, and he's a person of his own thinking in the scene. And listen, if I were to turn your question into a sermon, right, which is what all this material is, I would say, you know, even when you're in the presence of a Pharaoh, whose lack of sincerity is so obvious, most profound, you don't stop trying to bring the person from bad to good. That, but yeah, I know you don't have all for God yet. I know you just want to get rid of the hail. Maybe this time you'll be changed. I mean, that's what I would like. That's how I would drosh that out. That we should always be in a position, even the presence of the Pharaoh, to say maybe this time this person will be turned around. Joel and Tova.
I might be wrong, but I think this is the first time that it hints that the plagues are also to make the people change, right? You were going to say the same thing?
Same thing.
Because the Avadecha?
Yeah.
You mentioned the Avadecha before.
Yeah.
But in terms of changing your mind?
I'd have to look, but I mean, they've certainly grouped Pharaoh with his Avadeha and his, you know, in previous groups that he's addressing.
Mm-hmm. In terms of who the punishment is focused on, but not mm-hmm. that they actually have, not that actually matters when they change their mind.
Of them, uh-huh. you know, but
what do you make of that?
Well, the realization I came to near the beginning when I forgot what it was, we were talking about how at the end, the people were more than willing to let them go. So they gave them gifts and stuff like that. We originally addressed this question at the beginning. Why do we have to have 10 plagues? You know, why do we have to put all this punishment on them? And I think it was so that not only will Pharaoh want them to leave, but the people will want them to leave. Otherwise, the entire thing wouldn't have worked.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you could argue we've already seen aspects of that because we had the whole thing of some people going and putting their animals into shelter mm-hmm. because they'd evidently. So you could sort of read a growing process. Number who are, whatever Pharaoh may be doing and responding, are beginning to believe in the power that's being demonstrated.
It's an interesting comment, especially because we are, you know, a plague and a half away from the most direct assault, not just on Egyptian livestock, but on Egyptian people, mm-hmm. right? It reminds me of, it was a controversial but kind of renowned book that came out in the late 90s by Daniel Goldhagen called Hitler's Willing Executioners, mm-hmm. right? Basically his research into showing that obviously this Shoah wouldn't happen without Hitler, but how many of the people in the countrysides of the Ukraine and Poland were more than happy to assist the massacre. And of course, and it's clearly on my mind because it's the second time I'm dipping into it already today. I mean, that's the argument going on in the realm of pundits right now in terms of the residents of Gaza, right? And how we think about the extent to which the average Palestinian in Gaza, for whatever reason, is a passive or even active aider and abettor to Hamas's atrocities, and how that contributes to the ethics of the war that's going on. I'm not weighing in on that. I'm saying that's a discussion right now, right? So I wonder if, I'd never thought about this before, if your question of the inclusion of the Avadeha is kind of setting up a certain, I don't know, guilt or responsibility for the people who are about to get really decimated. Right, and that it's not just Pharaoh, but also the people that Pharaoh work with, the people, you know, Pharaoh's servants who are not yet converted. But no, but it's a, I appreciate the insight, Marshall.
I didn't really understand why Rashi had to bring up the issue of Tarim right now, but then there was a footnote in the Gelbart thing which just sort of explains it to me. He said there are other verses given to explain two manners of this word Tarim.
Yeah.
And the first one is in chapter 12 of Exodus, verse 34, Vayisa ha'am et betseko terem yechmatz.
Right.
Before the dough rises. Uh-huh. And then there was actually a one from Isaiah, Vahaya terem yigra'u, before they call, ani ene.
That's from the Torah of the fast day, I think. No, it gets put into the paragraph that the davener says on a fast day.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And those two examples show you that in English, the word before works,
yeah,
but
right.
not the way kodem works in Hebrew, even though the word kodem is translated as before. Yeah. Good. Anything else on this verse?
Okay, moving right along. The next verse, the next two verses is very strange. No one really...
What are they doing there?
No one really... has a sense of why the verses are there. They're written almost poetically. The Hebrew is very hard and condensed, and we're going to read them. We're going to try to understand them. But many a scholarly article have been written to figure out why the last two verses before we get to what the rabbis determined were the maftir of Parshat Va'era are there and what they're doing in the narrative, right? Were they added in afterwards? Are they kind of a double parentheses? I'm giving you that heads up. V'ha pishta, v'ha se'ora, nu kata ki hasora aviv vahapishta givo. You could know a lot of Hebrew and have no idea what this verse is going on, right? The vocab, the allusion, the tightness of the language there, it takes many, many more words to turn it into another language. Pishta, what is pishta? Flax, okay? The hasora, what's sora?
Barley.
So the flax and the barley, lo nu kata.
Nukata.
Sorry, nukata. I'm anticipating the next verse by accident. Nukata. For those who haven't looked at a translation yet, if you have, that's okay too. What do we think nukata might be connected to? What? There are two possible Hebrew verbs.
Lahakot.
It could be lahakot, which means to smite, and the nukata might be suggesting that it's in the nifal, right? That in the passive. So we're smitten, right? Maybe. Anyone else? Anyone have an association with the letters of that word? Has anyone ever been to a place in Israel where there's a sign towards the front of a bus or towards the closest entrance or a parking spot closest to the entrance to where you're going that is reserved for? Yeah. And how do you say handicapped in Hebrew?
Neche.
Neche, right? The nechim, right? Mm-hmm. So in that root, the nun is part of the root. It's nun kaf hey or nun kaf yud. In the possibility that Marshall gave, the root is lehakot, to smite, and the nun is part of the form. Those are the two main possibilities for how to understand this verse. Either way, whether it's nake or neche or hika, what we're being told is they were smitten or handicapped, right? That. Why we're being told this right now, again, I don't know, but the flax and the barley were smitten or were injured. Ki hasa'ora aviv. For the barley was aviv. What does the word aviv mean?
Spring.
Spring. It's the name of one of the seasons. But why does it mean spring?
We use it for spring.
For sprouting.
And the Karaites, in determining when it's going to be Nisan, go out to the wild barley fields. There are some in the West Bank. And they send a delegation out there periodically in the late winter, early spring, to see if the barley is aviv. And when it is, they will say, okay, this Rosh Chodesh will be Nisan, so that the barley will be aviv in time for the Omer to begin at Pesach. And that's how they determine the beginning of every year. So they are often a month ahead of us or a month behind us.
Right. Mm-hmm. But what does the word aviv mean to them?
That is not clear to me.
Beginning to sprout, visible in its ears, right? Yeah. So think of a barley grain, right? It's like this, these strands. Mm-hmm. And when at some point the fruit becomes visible, right? Just like a wheat field, you get close enough, you can actually see the grains in there. So the word aviv agriculturally means, I forgot to open up the BDB on this. I can do it quickly right now.
To start harvesting or soon to be ridden.
Yeah, you're at the place in the agricultural cycle where all of your hard work done months ago, mm-hmm. you know, first it was you saw nothing and then you saw the beginning of a plant and that plant got bigger. And now not only is the plant bigger, if you look closely, they're there, right? They're there, aviv, right? And if you think about, particularly those of you who did not grow up in Los Angeles, right? The beginning of spring is really a remarkable time of the year, right? In Connecticut, it was when the robins started to chirp. You felt like the earth was thawing. And when I woke up in the morning, you know, usually in late March and the open window, and I heard the birds chirping, it was, oh yes, it's really going to happen again this year, because through a long winter and certainly through a long Minnesotan winter.
It was only sometime late April.
Right? You can convince yourself that it'll never break, right? Yeah. And we're not farmers, but if you are a farmer, you can think of an analog in your own life. When you've toiled that much without any guarantee that the toil is going to yield us something, when you see the grains in, you know, actually present, aviv. Oh, I guess spring is going to come. And all the work that I was doing is going to have paid off. Let me just look up aviv in BDB really quickly. I think it would be interesting.
In Croatia.
Yeah, everything goes back to Croatia. To
the national park. It, the lake seems so much less impressive than we're used to seeing at national parks because the beech trees, which predominate, had not yet begun to green.
Yeah.
So there was all this gray matter and a few few pine trees. And less than a week later, right over the hill in Split and in Dubrovnik, we were on the coast where spring clearly had begun. There was much more greenery. I remember marking at one point that a particular view reminded me of when I was in the springtime in St. Charles, Illinois, which is a third of the way from Chicago to the Iowa border. And it was like top to bottom, a sea of spring green, a color that we don't see in California very often, but reminded me of a spring green crayon from my childhood.
Yeah.
Look, and there it was.
Look at BDB on the root Aleph Bet Bet, fresh and bright from the Assyrian Ababu, from a core verb, core set of letters, Aleph Bet, meaning freshness or fresh green. So it's interesting that it's associated deep in its etymology with greenness, but when it comes to actual agriculture, it got associated with the presence of the thing that's going to become the fruit. And now look at the next entry, the word Aviv itself, fresh young ears of barley. Again, I understand that the significance to be fresh young ears of barley that you can see with your eyes. It's not just that they've grown, but they have produced, right? I know, think about anyone who's experienced pregnancy in their body or with their partner. When you see that first sonogram and there's actually something growing there and there's a heartbeat, that's amazing, right? So a farmer has an agricultural version of that every single year.
Do you think it's just a coincidence that like the beginning is the beginning of the alphabet?
What do you mean?
Alphabet is like...
I don't think anything's a coincidence. That's actually a possibility. Okay, Larry, Diane?
There you go. Okay. So maybe I missed it. I'm understanding here that the word Aviv, which we think to be spring, is actually coming from the barley, right?
Correct.
And what I wanted to say is not related to that. It's what if you connect this verse, and we haven't gotten to the next, but in the next, what if you connect it to the end of the, to the entirety of verse 30? In other words, forget that you've got a sof pasuk, that you put it as one verse. And then you would say, then you would read it as, but I know that you, and I'm reading the translation JPS, you and your courtiers do not fear Hashem, so the flax and the barley, I can't deal with the tense here, are ruined because the barley was in the ear. So this is your punishment for not believing in God or not fearing God.
I thought you were going to say something else. Let me tell you what I thought you were going to say, and then I'll deal with what you said. I thought you were going to say that maybe the connection between 30 and 31 is I know that all you are is upset at what's happened to your society, because after all, this plague came once all of the flax and the barley, which we rely on, has started to bud and therefore are ruined. You're saying it as a quid pro quo. The reason why you're experiencing this is because you don't fear God. I thought you were going to say, I know that you're just being, you're just focused on your immediate needs right now, rather than having gone through some kind of transformation. But either way, it's an interesting connection. And as we read verse 32, which we may or may not get to today, we'll try to connect that. Even if we do that, it's a weird couplet. It's just written, these verses are written differently than the rest of the narrative for pages in either direction. Marshall, and then Tova, and then Sue.
First, the altered translation of the sentence, and then a footnote, which is really quite interesting.
Okay.
And the flax and the barley were struck, for the barley was in bud, and the flax was in ear.
Okay. We hadn't translated that last phrase. We got stuck on that Aviv, but it's okay. Baha pishta. So, but look at the chiasm, pishta sora, and then sora pishta.
like the flax and the barley were smitten or were injured, for the barley, which was mentioned second, was already showing the hapishta, and the flax was in bud. Okay.
And the second is from Umberto Casuta, who we've talked about before, who reminds us that flax was used to make linen, a principal Egyptian fabric for clothing, and also an important Egyptian export item. And goes on to suggest that the barley would have been used for cheap bread to feed slaves. So there's an economic element here, which Pharaoh is really going to be feeling.
Yeah, including the feeding of this very slaves that he wants to stay in Egypt. Sue, project.
I don't remember the order of exactly where we are, but we've got all these conversations with Moses and Pharaoh, and Moses and Pharaoh, and you got to let us go, and you got to let us, and we got to go. And we have the hail, and it definitely affects the animals and the people. But now this is really obviously very specific about the crops that were exactly ready to be, you know, that the critical time for the crops. So it's affects the people. I mean, this is really the people that, you know, kind of takes it up. The Avadecha is where I'm going with this, that this really throws it all on the people, even bigger than we got the animals with the hail and blah, blah, blah. But this is just kind of reinforces the fact that it's everything. And this is going to, you know, your people or your Avadecha are going to be.
And the two basic economic things upon which you subsist, like the food items, the barley, and the stuff that you're making your clothing from, the pishta, they are ruined from this.
Did you sound funny there?
No. It was partly because I was going to comment on the same things, but it was going to go in a different direction as I was considering the arguments that I'd heard. One, I would say that the use of avadecha, they're talking about the courtiers. They're not talking about the servants. They're not talking about the common people. That I would be pretty confident about. And that had led me to focus on the fact, I mean, I think fundamentally it's because they're talking about what naturally ripened first. But the flax, yes, it was used for clothing, but it hit me as most significant because the wearing of very fine sheer linen was one of the greatest markers of rank. And therefore, that the flax, I mean, it's almost like an attack against the Avadecha and Pharaoh, the upper class, which is like the opposite of what you were saying. That's why I was kind of rolling both ideas around in my head. Barley, the comment that it was for slaves, certainly historically it's been. I'm not sure that was the case in Egypt necessarily. I think it was equally consumed. It wasn't considered lesser than wheat, which later came to be the case. I'm not sure. Absolutely. And also, I will say that beer, they didn't have a currency in Egypt. Salaries were paid in the form of bread and beer. If you go all the way back to the pyramids, they had huge breweries and huge bakeries. That was
not people. Not sure everyone on Zoom heard that. We just had a 47 second exposition on beer, which is always a good thing. Rick, you're going to be the last comment of the day.
The text is just telling us that the matzah was made from the wheat and not the barley, because the barley was gone.
Yeah. We're not going to get to it this week. We'll get to it next week. We'll see the second verse of this couplet. And then we can linger for a bit on whether we think this is organic to the narrative or if it was like 19th century German biblical critics have field day with these two verses. Like this, it almost seemed like it was an editorial comment thrown in the middle of the story. Oh, by the way, this is where they were in the season, right? That it's very hard to weave this in. It's like bad editing, right? If you assume an editing process. But we're only halfway through that couplet and we'll meet next week. And good to see everybody, and shalom, and nice to see these particular four again. Bye, everybody.
You have been listening to another in our series of podcasts from Temple Beth Am, a dynamic center for conservative Judaism in Los Angeles. If you enjoy these podcasts, we invite you to write a review on the Apple Podcast site or wherever you get your podcasts.
For more information about Temple Beth Am Los Angeles, go to tbala.org.